Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hi, I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute, and this is Democracy Sausage, which comes to you twice a week from the Crawford School of Public Policy and the School of Politics and International Relations at the ANU, Australia's National University. Now, it's becoming almost tawdry to bang on about 2020, you know, the year from hell, as many would have it, but it certainly has been bizarre, and it continues in that vein. Donald Trump, a shabby and discredited figure, lingers on, lying to himself and to his millions of devotees, that he won an election that everyone else can see that he quite plainly lost. Australia's armed services worry about being subject to Japan's death penalty if convicted of serious crimes while stationed in that country under a plan unveiled last week, even as we learned in the same week that some members of Australia's most elite defence forces actually believe in delivering the death penalty to some people, and it's a really shocking story that we saw come out of Afghanistan. And of course, the China relationship went from bad to worse, with the Morrison government showing no clue as to how to improve things in our national interest, the same national interest they endlessly invoke. And last week also, there was that really weird South Australian, what I'm calling mockdown rather than lockdown. But really, it was an attempt to get on the front foot and deal with the situation that state faced, but it had to be aborted when it turned out that situation had been based on largely on a single lie from someone that they had contacted through contact tracing. So it's just, you know, mind-boggling the way things are going this year. Nothing seems to be particularly predictable, and most of the stories are negative, although not all, of course. As I said, there has been a change in the White House, and that promises at least eventually a return to some sort of sanity. And it is still November, so there's a bit of time yet for this year. Joining me, as usual on the podcast, is the wonderful and newly research grant-leavened Dr. Maria Taflager from the School of Politics and International Relations, as I said. Welcome back, Maria.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, 2020 isn't all bad, I suppose, but, you know, what will December bring? Locusts. I predict locusts.
I think there have been some locusts on the horizon. I saw something about locusts. I think Brian Schmidt was making a point about locusts in some plague proportion somewhere in Victoria.
Well, I regret saying that.
Yeah. I know the grass is just absolutely insane around Canberra. And
yes.
I've discovered to my horror that I've got allergies that or sensitivities that, frankly, I didn't really know I had. And, you know, the pollen count is just absolutely berserk. In the circle across from where I live, what passes for a council in the ACT, which is basically the ACT government, has had to come out, you know, with the tractors and mow it. And they're doing it about every 2 weeks because, you know, if you don't, it's kind of 6 foot high. Well, not 6 foot, but.
Oh, I fear our house will just be enveloped by the grass.
Yeah.
one non-vigilant weekend and we'll never find our dog again.
Well, I've got a Velcro dog, which is a brand of a dog. It's a Schnauzer. But when Vincent comes back from his walk, that you know, I take him on each day. It literally is, you know, 5-10 minutes of just extracting all of these grass seeds out of him because it's just horrendous. Anyway, enough on dogs. Also with us is Quentin Grafton. And Quentin Grafton, of course, is an economist, but he's also chairholder of the UNESCO Chair in Water Economics and Transboundary Water Governance here at the Crawford School of Public Policy. Welcome back, Quentin.
Thanks, Mike. A pleasure to be here.
You've been on the podcast many times. And one of the reasons you're here today, and there's a number of things that we can talk to you about, but one of the key reasons is that you released some interesting research last week in partnership with University of Melbourne, I believe.
Yes, that's right. I had two other co-authors, and we had a paper published in Royal Society Open Science. And that paper is what's called backcasting. So in other words, we take the number of fatalities through COVID, let's say today, November 23rd, and we go back in time to work out how many infections we would need to have had, let's say 3 weeks ago, approximately, to be able to get the number of fatalities today. So that's what's called backcasting. So we go back in time to work out what those levels of infections were.
And so if I could just stop you there. So essentially what we've been doing up until now is we're detecting a certain number of infections through people coming forward and being tested. We know some of those people develop symptoms and they end up, if those symptoms become serious, they might end up in hospital and regrettably some of those don't survive. And so that's essentially the ballpark we understand up until that point. And what you're saying is you can actually now, with the value of experience of all this, you can look at the infection rates and extrapolate backwards how many people out there have been carrying the virus. Is that what you're saying?
You extrapolate from the fatality rates. So we have a distribution around the fatality rates. So we know it can't be less than a certain number and it's unlikely to be greater than another number. So those are the two endpoints. And then you take the number of deaths that you would have today, the number of fatalities due to COVID, and then you calculate based on those proportions, those probabilities associated with the fatalities, which is low but still high by comparison to, let's say, influenza and a bunch of other diseases. Then you're able to calculate how many people got infected 3 or 4 weeks ago. And so you not only need fatality rates, but you also need to have some distribution around the time period it takes to get infected, to get symptoms, 4 to 7 days. And then from symptoms to if you happen to pass away because of COVID, you know, it could be 14 to 19 days. So you take those three sets of parameters, you create distributions around them. And from that, you can create a measure of the true or the population infection rate, which is much higher than what you would get through the testing that we, you know, when you go to, I've been tested for COVID, you go in there, you get the sputum sample, you get the saliva sample, like you get the result hopefully within 48 hours. And then they say, positive or negative. And so when you're positive, you get a confirmed case. That's the number that you see in the Johns Hopkins websites or the World Health Organization. And those numbers are much, much less than what the actual or true population numbers. In some countries, it's very, very, very bad in the sense the detection rates through the testing of the RNA testing is what I'm talking about is very, very low. Some countries is pretty good, like South Korea is one of the best in the world. Australia was the best at the end of April in the 15 countries we sampled. So in some countries, it's horrific how low the detection rate is. So United Kingdom, for example, you know, you've got a number of infections, people who have been infected and have recovered or currently infected, approximately 16, that's 16 times larger than the confirmed cases. Italy, it's about 17 times larger. That's a huge difference. It's not just a little difference, it's a huge difference. And it has big implications for how you manage the pandemic, has big implications for what you've been doing so far, as well as going forward, has big implications for people who, let's say, are vulnerable. If you're a vulnerable person, you have some morbidities, your high blood pressure, diabetes, a certain age, etc., and you live in London, England, you better be very careful because our results are suggesting to you that there's a much, much higher chance of getting COVID than you think by just looking at those confirmed cases.
It raises so many interesting questions. For example, does it mean that COVID is significantly more contagious than we thought? I mean, it seems if it's moving around the community at as you say, 15, 16 times the amount that we understand, then presumably all those messages about stay 1.5 metres apart and open a window and all those things, which is essentially predicated on the notion that being in close in with, you know, someone's proximity exposes you to, you know, droplets from their breathing and coughing and so forth, but that also there's an amount of time that it increases over, you know, the longer you're in that proximity, the more risk you're at. And what this suggests is that there's a lot of people picking it up, and I don't want to sort of, you know, pick on the dude in South Australia who made up the story about having just bought a pizza, but are there people picking it up from having just bought a pizza or the equivalent? I mean, that could be one conclusion.
Well, there's obviously, yeah, there's lots of people who've picked up COVID globally, and according to our numbers, much, much more than the confirmed cases would suggest. So, yes, it is highly contagious. We know certain things about the virus in terms of infections. So you need to get a certain viral load to get infected. So you don't just have to get, you know.
Well, this is not something that people – you don't hear this said much.
Yeah, so masks really clearly will help. If someone who's infected wearing a mask and you're wearing a mask, that will clearly help.
Yeah, because there's basically six layers of material between you and them.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and we know there's aerosol transmission, so that means outside the virus will get dispersed, obviously, but that's not going to be true in a closed space environment. Right. So that's why it seems that we're getting the rates of infection going up, which they are. It's exploding.
Particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, entering in colder weather and people are indoors.
Exactly, yeah. So going into a pub, for example, in the United Kingdom is not a good idea. Obviously, now restrictions have been place since November 5th in the United Kingdom, but doing that sort of activity, you know, relatively large number of people around, not wearing masks, talking loudly, et cetera, you know, that's a classic place to be picking up COVID, or public transportation, for example.
Well, yeah, I mean, anyone can, you know, remember either doing it or seeing pictures of London buses with the windows fogged up, you know, or people inside because it's so cold outside and, you know, packed full of people. And that's the way people get around in London. They get around on the tube or on the bus.
Exactly. So this is where wearing masks is critically important. So there are cultural differences in different places. So some places in Asia, for example, where wearing masks is perfectly acceptable and pretty much everyone does it. In effect, if you don't wear a mask, it's socially unacceptable.
Yeah.
So that does help. It doesn't guarantee, of course, but it does help if everyone's wearing a mask on public transportation, for example.
To be clear, though, what you're sort of saying is that – you know, this is a comparative study based on data from April, yeah?
Our latest numbers were from the end of August.
Okay. So I have two questions. The first one is, I guess, like what you're really saying is that some of these gaps, like the really big ones, are sort of showing, I guess, a deficiency in countries' testing regimes. And I imagine that South Korea, the gap between what they actually find in their actual N and what you're forecasting would be much smaller.
That's right. So their detection rate is much better in the South Korea. That's what we'd be finding. And what you also said as well, Maria, there is a relationship between the proportion of people testing positive through the RNA test, you know, the saliva sputum test, and the detection rate. It's a negative relationship. So your higher positivity rate in those RNA tests, then the worse your detection rate. So we can identify that way. And we've got a consistent negative correlation both at the end of April and at the end of August. So that's another way of testing.
Let's unpack that a bit. The higher higher infection rate than the lower detection rate.
Yeah, so if you get 100 people going into the facility to get tested, you know, through the RNA type test that we're familiar with, you know, and the higher the proportion, let's say it's 5 or 10 out of 100, that would be pretty high.
That'd be high, yeah.
Okay, high positivity rate is what that would be. Then that would mean that you've got a lower rate of detection of the overall community.
So not enough people are going forward to be tested, or perhaps in the case of the UK, especially in the early months, people simply weren't allowed to get a test because there weren't enough of them.
Yeah, that's right. And there was that whole thing about you had to really convince them. And in fact, my wife and I went to the testing station. I think I've spoken about this before on this pod, but we went to a testing station in Canberra at one stage, and because she had you know, a bad cold sort of situation, or at least, you know, throat symptoms and so forth, and we figured, well, you know, we'll both get tested. And as soon as I answered the question that I didn't have any symptoms, they told me, you know, step away from the counter, sir. You know, you're not getting a test. And I said, yeah, but if she's positive, right, I mean, we live together, for Christ's sake. So if she's positive, then presumably so am I. Whereas we leave that test, we don't know for 48 hours. I haven't been tested. I don't have any sort of restrictions on me. It just seems cockamamie, really, to run it like that. But that was the case all around because of,
rationing.
I suppose, yeah, rationing, really. They couldn't provide enough tests, and so you really had to convince them that you had symptoms.
I had a colleague who actually his breathing became so bad that I think a friend of his called an ambulance. They put him on oxygen. His oxygen levels weren't sufficiently bad for him to be admitted, and they left him, and he never got a test, right? You know, and so that gives you a sort of sense of the sort of public policy kind of fiasco. And he contracted that disease at a conference in the COVID. He contracted COVID in the United States. My second question, Quinton, is,
well, we had Bevan Shields on the pod talking about his experience, and it was pretty much the same as you just described. I mean, he had the ambulance come. This was in the early stages of the disease progress in London. And they basically convinced him. That was at the same time Boris Johnson was actually in the hospital. And they basically said to him, look, I mean, it's a slightly different detail, but they said, look, unless you really demand to be taken to the hospital, I wouldn't if I were you, because you're just going to end up on a gurney in a corridor somewhere, and you really don't want to be there. There's a lot of sick people there.
That does not fill you with confidence.
No.
My second question is, you know, and this may be beyond the scope of the paper, but I'm interested, which is, we know that doctors have gotten better at treating this disease, and so have you been able to sort of account for that in this paper as well?
Yeah, the fatality rates appear to be dropping for a variety of reasons, but not only from some drugs that are being applied, but also in terms of how quickly people have been put on the ventilators. There's some delay, etc. So that's good. No, so if there's a change in the fatality rate, the substantial change, then our backcasting method will have a bias towards it. Another critique of our method is the demographics. So if if you're comparing countries which have very different demographics, so a country that has a much younger population, for example, with another country that has a much older population, that's not a useful comparison, simply because the fatality rates are so much more in the older population. So there are certainly caveats, which we're very clear about in our published paper, to talk through that and say that there are weaknesses. But those weaknesses, of course, in the confirmed cases, there's also weaknesses in seroprevalence studies. So that's another way of testing, is that you actually take blood samples and you work out whether they have antibodies or not. So if Maria's friend didn't get tested for COVID, that person could still get tested with a seropositive test to determine whether they have antibodies, whether they in fact did have COVID at some time in the past. So we have been able to make comparisons with those sero studies, those blood sample studies, with ours, where it's possible, and we get similar sorts of numbers.
So that's interesting. So it effectively verifies the result
pretty,
by another
pretty,
method.
Pretty much. So I think the key point is not whether it's 16 times more or 17 times more in the United Kingdom. That's not really what we're talking about. We're just saying it's multiples more in the United Kingdom than is given out by the UK government statistics or the John Hopkins or the WHO. And that has serious implications, I think, for how we manage the pandemic in those sorts of countries. And other countries, with South Korea and Australia, by the way, was the best at the end of April. It was number 5 in our sample at the end of August. But remember, it's not ancient history, but remember at the end of August we had Victoria. So Victoria's lockdown gets underway 2nd and then also the 5th of August. So there were still a large number of cases at that time. So our detection rate was not so good at that point, simply because there was actually substantial hidden transmission. Now our detection rate, I would imagine, is much, much higher, and certainly verified in the numbers of thousands of people who are tested in South Australia, that lots of people are being tested regularly in New South Wales, and we're getting very, very, very low numbers. So it would suggest that our detection rate is much, much better than it was, let's say, at the end of August.
And it does raise important implications, just as you say, Quinton, because I think that the number that people are actually focusing on when they're listening to the news is the one that is reported, which is zero cases and zero deaths. And so if you hear zero cases and zero deaths, well, maybe you'll like be a bit more complacent and not use the hand sanitizer station and all of those things. And perhaps it doesn't matter so much in a country like Australia, given that we seem to be pursuing an elimination strategy, but it might matter a lot more if you live in, Europe where they can't police borders. And I guess the final thing I would sort of say about this is what has been really nice about this discussion is like these are exactly the kinds of things we need to sort of think about when we hear data or data produced, which we do all the time, right, particularly in the economic sphere, these kinds of, that was, I guess, one of the core complaints or kind of conflicts about whether or not the Victorian response to the virus was the appropriate one. And the Treasurer sort of raised the point about, well, what is the appropriate comparison? Is it between Europe and Australia, or is it between Australia and the other states? And the actual
Victoria
correct
Victoria and the other states, yeah.
Yeah, Victoria and the other Australian states. And the actual correct answer is, well, what is the question, right? So if it is about when you have certain numbers in infection rates, then, the appropriate comparison for Victoria is with Europe. But if you're perhaps going from the beginning of the pandemic, then perhaps the appropriate comparison is the other Australian states. And I think this is how we are manipulated, folks. So pay attention.
Yeah, well, I think it's a really interesting point because, it strikes me about that whole, febrile Victorian debate was really skewed because people either wanted to conflate the two things, that is the failure of hotel quarantine and what happened next, as if it was all part of the same problem, when in fact the second part of it was the solution to the first part. And then there was the whole debate, allied to that, which was around Victoria's ability to, do contact tracing, contact testing or testing and contact tracing, which was, came in for a lot of criticism. But the lockdown itself, and we shouldn't pretend that it didn't come at a huge cost to the economy and at a huge social and personal cost for a lot of people, and that cost will continue. But nonetheless, when you are faced with the sort of numbers that they were faced with in terms of new infections and fatalities, particularly ripping through the aged care sector, then quite dramatic means are called for. So the idea that you can make a comparison between two jurisdictions, say Victoria and WA or Victoria and South Australia and New South Wales, when they've got, in the case of New South Wales, they had double digit only and low double digits at that for a good part of that time or in single figures. And those other jurisdictions, no new infections, that's not a valid comparison because they had vast numbers of infections, new infections happening in Victoria. And the question is, what do you do when you have vast number of infections? Do you do what is being done in the UK? I would say no. Or what's been done in the USA? Clearly no, because we know where this all leads. And we can talk about that. I mean, what are the numbers at the moment? 55 million infections globally. I think there's 1.3 million deaths. In the US, 12.3 million infections, 256,000 deaths as of today. I mean, is that the kind of thing? They're getting 2,000 deaths every 24 hours?
Yeah, I think this is the point, right? Like the reason why a pandemic might go out of control is actually has potentially multiple mechanisms, right? So multiple factors that may see it sort of take off and become out of control. And you don't necessarily always need the same mechanisms to trigger this point, which is sort of what you were sort of saying in relation to the fact that their problems with hotel quarantine are conflated with the overall number of cases. But, it seems to be that there are other problems in place, such as the fact that contact tracing wasn't up to the task, for example.
But contact tracing becomes much harder when it gets overwhelmed, right?
Well, I think this is the key
Precisely.
Point. So the studies done in terms of the sort of number of contacts you'll have for someone who tests positive, it's approximately 36, okay, but let's say it's over 30. Some people, of course, it's well over 100.
So you're saying for someone who tests positive?
You need, on average, your over 30 contacts have to be traced, and they have to be traced within 48 hours. So you just do the math on this.
Mm.
If you're starting to get 30 new cases a day,
yeah.
okay, 900 contacts have to be done in 48 hours.
Yeah.
You need many, many contact tracers who are qualified, able to do that, and do that at a very short notice. Okay, so these people aren't going to be out there just waiting in the empty offices. They have to be presumably doing something, so then they have to transfer the activities.
Mm.
So in a country like Australia, once you start to get more than 30 cases per day, new cases, you start to lose control. When you hit 100, we've lost control.
Mm.
And Victoria's numbers, okay, were well over
100. Well, yeah,
they went up to 680, yeah. okay, so yeah. just before they put in the stage four lockdown. So what's happening in Western Europe, what's happening in the United States, contact tracing, I'm not against it. Of course, it's part of the mix here, but it's not going to work when you're having thousands and thousands, 40-odd thousand in France.
Yeah.
I mean, give me a break. I mean, there's no way you can do that effectively. So the whole system is broken down. So the only option, if you want to suppress infection at that point, there is only one option, and that is social distancing in various types and measures, and that need to be set up in an appropriate way, et cetera, et cetera. But it's basically making sure that the contacts that people have are limited, especially inside, and you can do it multiple ways. And we know how we did it in Melbourne, and it was highly successful. Okay, so we know it works. It's not just in Melbourne. We know it worked in Wuhan. We know it worked in New Zealand. We know it worked in a bunch of jurisdictions. So we know it works. The question is, what is the objective? In the context of Australia, it has been by default a community elimination of the virus. Explicitly in New Zealand, it was. In Western Europe, that was never the case.
Mm.
That was all about avoiding hospitals reaching a certain threshold point, in particular the intensive care units. So they made a call on that. They thought they made the right call. And in summer, you could read a bunch of people, however you want to call them, columnists, who are writing and saying, look at the Europe model. This is that worked. You know, we got numbers down to a few hundred. But even at that point, anyone who's worked at this area would have worked out, once you're getting several hundred cases a day, which they were in the large Western European countries, they were setting themselves up for what is happening right now, because their contact tracing system is unlikely to be sufficient with less stringent social distancing to be able to manage and control the infections. And clearly that's what's happened. So it should have come as no surprise that we are experiencing what we are experiencing in the United Kingdom and Western Europe. And unfortunately, when you set up these lockdowns, so-called lockdowns, they have to be in for a sufficiently long enough period of time. So if it's 4 weeks, which appears to be what the UK is heading for, it's not going to be enough. And so what it means is you get the flattening of the curve, but you'll still have sufficient large enough numbers, and they will come back up.
Because especially, it's exponential.
Yeah, because it's exponential, and also because of what your research shows, which is that there's a lot of latent infection that hasn't been detected and which, you know, can bubble up in multiple ways. Let's take a very quick break and back in a moment.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, just before the break, we were talking about COVID and infection rates and the different ways it's being handled. Bevan Shields, who I mentioned earlier, who's the Fairfax, or what's now called Nine Newspapers, correspondent for Europe, and has been on this podcast a few times, a good old colleague of mine, he's tweeted that Britain is Britain is abandoning a key measure to control the virus. The UK Daily Telegraph is reporting that Boris Johnson will announce tomorrow, that is today, our time, I suppose, that contacts of positive cases will no longer have to self-isolate for 14 days. This is a huge change, but compliance has been low anyway. So in other words, you know, it wasn't really working. People aren't taking this seriously, so we're going to abandon it. And this, it, you know, this goes to the point you were just making, Quentin, about you know, the political will, I suppose, to see these things through. The government in the UK, and this has been the case, as we know, with Trump's administration in the US, far more of an eye to the politics all the time than to the health thing. I mean, is that just an admission that it's well out of beyond their control anyway now? And if they impose harsh measures, they carry all the political downside and they still can't really get this thing under control?
Well, the politics is one thing, and I can talk to that, but we certainly know that they can get this under control. It's not mission impossible.
Even from where they are?
Absolutely, it's possible. China's demonstrated, we've demonstrated, other countries have demonstrated, but it requires consistency in messaging. It requires social distancing.
But there are several orders of magnitude beyond even the worst situation.
It's simply about yes, of course, it's going to be a problem. I'm not suggesting but we're talking, you know, an 8-week type of social distancing, lockdown, however you want to call it, will make a huge difference. Now, the issue for Western Europe, they made decisions around their borders. Now, if you bring your numbers way down, okay, very low numbers, let's say, in the United Kingdom or France or whatever, you have to do something about your border control. Mm. Because if you bring your numbers down and other countries haven't, and they're traveling by air or train or whatever it is, then you're going to get back to the way you were. So you have to have some method of control around that. Now, we know that's problematic even in Australia, not just in Victoria. We know in South Australia, we know in New South Wales, there are, in fact, have been outbreaks that came out of the hotel quarantine. Now, fortunately, in other jurisdictions, they've managed to stop that getting into the big outbreak or so-called second wave. But there are clear issues associated with that. People coming back to Australia, the positivity rates of those people coming in, it's about 2-3%. Okay, so 6,000 people coming in a week. You know, so in other words, if we don't have 14-day quarantine and appropriate testing of them, plus, of course, the people working in those hotels or facilities, then, of course, we are going to get COVID again and again and again. So that's the whole point of it. You have to have border control. You have to have contact tracing and testing. And as necessary, certainly if you've got very low numbers or zero numbers, as we have at most places in Australia right now, then you don't need to have those hard, stringent social distancing measures. But when you have those numbers, when the outbreak is starting, let's say it escapes from quarantine as it had in South Australia just a few days ago, or a little over a couple of weeks ago, well, I don't know exact date it came out. Well, those sorts of measures need to be quick, they need to be fast, they need to be hard, because the payoff is that you only have to have them in for a relatively short period of time. Because when you have the large sets of numbers, then you're into a whole different sort of 6-week, 8-week
situation. And we saw exactly what happens when you have the large sets of numbers. You have a 4-month lockdown.
That's right. And Maria, that was essentially what was driving the South Australian government's snap lockdown, wasn't it? That logic that if you can act very, very quickly right at the start, you don't have to act for anywhere near as long.
Yes. And I mean, there's been a lot of, criticism of what's happened in South Australia, because it's become apparent that an individual who is on a temporary work visa misled a contact tracer about the fact that they worked at a pizzeria, which kind of goes to some policy choices made at the federal level around the economic support for vulnerable people in our community. But, you know, based on the available information the South Australian government had, not really understanding the full parameters of exactly how many potential cases were out there in the community, and, you know, they also sort of believed that this was a much more infectious strain of the virus, the precautionary principle was, you know, the right one. And what we, I guess, don't know is, effectively is what the confidence the South Australian government had in its capacity to contact trace at these potentially high numbers. And the downside risk is to end up in a 4-month lockdown, which we have seen. We you know, the sort of psychological and economic devastation of that, and that will only become more clear to us in time. And I think it is a bit disappointing that the Premier himself is effectively undermining I guess the sort of sagacity of his own judgment by castigating this dude for lying, which is a problem. But you know, I think they're going to punish him quite severely now. And unfortunately, we just sort of know from psychology that this is not going to help people not lie to contract tracers in the future, right? Like, it's actually an exercise in building trust. And it would be better, I think, if Stephen Marshall sort of praised his community for responding in the way that they did. And, you know, basically, well, let's look at how we ask people questions to encourage them to be truthful, rather than, you know, creating a situation where they're fearful.
Yeah, and don't put them in a situation where there's an incentive for them to
lie.
To deceive, because essentially they have no choice. There's no social support network, no, you know, welfare safety net for them in that circumstance. There's a lot of people, as we know, in the economy who are in this kind of precariat, as it's described nowadays, you know, whose hold in the labour market is very temporary or precarious, and who are needing to have more than one job. This was a problem, of course, in Victoria in the aged care sector as well, where we found that there were people working in aged care in multiple or at least more than one aged care facility. Well, anyone who's had anything to do with those facilities knows that these people are the lifeblood of the system. They absolutely keep the aged care sector going, and they're very poorly remunerated for that. And it's not surprising that people are needing to work more than one job in order to meet the costs of living. Just on Victoria, though, and I just want to make this point because I think it's an interesting one. And I'll be interested in your responses to this. But even if you accept the hotel quarantine stuff up that led to it, can you actually think of a single public policy lever that you've seen pulled that has been so effective? I mean, I think it's 24 days or 21 days, some sort of number like that now, of zero, no new infections and no deaths in Victoria. From, I think it peaked at 725 new infections at one point in a single day. It was, and of course, something like 800 of the 900 deaths in Australia are from Victoria. And it worked. I mean, you've been doing modelling, Quentin. The modelling that they were talking about and the sort of timeline they were predicting for bringing this down to an acceptable number, and zero is a very acceptable number in this regard, it worked.
It's a triumph. We did modelling in Victoria. In fact, our model, I mean, I'm not trying to boast or anything, but our model was very close to what's actually happened.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So, but that indicates that the compliance rate was high, and that once stage four was implemented, 2nd or 5th of August, it worked. It clearly worked. And the point about it is that in July, when they had the stage three lockdown, it wasn't working in the sense that the rates of growth were still positive. It reduced the rate of increase, but it was still positive. So we had to go to stage four. There was no alternative. If we'd gone earlier, it would have been better, but that's the nature of decision making at the time. But the point about it is that it did work. And in the context of South Australia, or indeed any jurisdiction, the earlier you go in, the harder you go in, the shorter the period is required, because when you have exponential growth, every day you wait means it can blow up.
Yeah.
And also in the context of contact tracing, I pointed out that, you know, if it's 30 plus a day new cases, you start to lose control. So you want to get in there as quickly as you can and do something, and that's the payoff. And in the context of the Victorian economy, we again did modeling. We looked the counterfactual, and Maria made the point, well, what is the question that you should be asking?
Yeah,
well, the counterfactual is, what was the alternative if they hadn't Victorian government had not instituted a stage four on a 2nd and a 5th of August. Well, what the alternative was would have been many more thousands of deaths. There would have been many thousands of deaths. and there would have been a huge impact on the economy. And so we've done those.
And Victoria would have been walled off to the rest of the country completely indefinitely.
So we've got numbers there in the vicinity, depending on the scenario you want to construct, the counterfactual. You know, minimum, you know, 130, but upwards to $200 to $300 billion just for the Victorian economy. By comparison, the cost of the lockdown is somewhere between 20 to 30 billion. I'm not trivializing, that's a very large sum. But it's multiples more if you had kept at stage three and rather than going to stage four. So those are the facts and figures you need to look at. It's not just a public health benefit. Of course it's a public benefit, but it's also an economy benefit. And you'll see it in the United Kingdom. I can make a prediction right now. The United Kingdom's economy is in the toilet.
It is,
and it's going to go worse simply because, and excuse the language, they've done a clusterfuck in the context of how they have responded to COVID from the very top. And in fact, I'm going to make a suggestion. I'm going to write to Netflix tonight and say, create a new series rather than have The Crown, create a new series called The Clown. And you can imagine who that person could be in the lead role and his family.
Does he look like he cut his hair with bacon scissors?
So I mean, the point about it is politicians, leaders need to be accountable for the decisions that they've made. And they have received expert advice. In the context of the United Kingdom, there are other countries. I don't want to just hit on the UK. But they did receive advice. On the 21st of September, SAGE, this is this advisory committee of senior advisors, you know, government emergencies, they provided that advice, written advice to go in and go hard at that time, 21st of September. It took until the 5th of November. And you can just add up, it wouldn't be hard to do, you could add up the consequences in terms of deaths in the United Kingdom from that decision making. Not only is it increased deaths, morbidities, and there are morbidities associated with COVID, maybe 10% of people have long-term issues associated once they've recovered from COVID. Yeah. And then there's the economy side. The supposed idea is that you get this better economy. Well, one of the worst countries in the world in terms of its economy, in terms of COVID, will be the United Kingdom. And there will be other countries included.
Speaking of the clown, there's plenty of clowns around who completely miss that argument that you've just put, who seem to be suggesting in everything they say in criticising Victoria or South Australia or anywhere else that if we just got to learn to live with the virus, that you know, it's perfectly fine, you can do it, and your economy can continue on largely untrammelled by the virus. I mean,
that is the principal debate in the United Kingdom, and that's one of the reasons why I imagine compliance is a lot lower there, because there has been those inconsistencies. I mean, I think what the Victorian case seems to sort of demonstrate, if we use the rest of Australia as a comparator, and you know, I'm really looking forward to whoever actually studies this in great depth, is that there were obviously clear government infrastructure problems in the way the Victorian Health Department and its capacity for contact tracing was set up. And it is actually quite possible that Victoria's situation might mimic the rest of the country, except for New South Wales, because ultimately they've been able to shut their borders and pretty much have zero transmission for a very long time. But that seems to be one of the reasons why, you know, the dam sort of managed to crack beyond the point where patching it up, I suppose, would sort of save the situation, i.e. contact tracing. And that is actually quite important to actually unpick what it was about Victoria that set it off on this pathway, because the reality is that you cannot make hotel quarantine 100% safe, just like you can't in hospitals. Like, there's a reason why health professionals who are trained in PPE, you know, still get sick. Yeah. It's because they're surrounded by it and they're getting like high viral loads, right? And so, you know, I think, and this is actually critically kind of important for how we sort of manage these kinds of complex policy problems. And that's sort of what I was getting at when I say that there's actually more than one mechanism at play as to why we get these problems. And if you do not have good information, if you really don't know the portion of your unknown, then yeah, a lockdown is absolutely the better reaction early and quickly before it gets out of control. New South Wales seems to be in a different situation. They seem to have have a much better grip on what the actual problem set is that they're facing.
Yeah, well,
that,
they were definitely worried in South Australia, weren't they? Because they had 4,000 people in quarantine.
Exactly.
You know, within hours of identifying this primary infection. They'd identified, I think it was 4,000, which is a huge number of people that they'd essentially ordered into self-isolation anyway. And that was also an abundance of caution, but for the right reasons. Just before we leave this, because I want to just get on to talking about climate change briefly before we go, but just before we leave this, Maria, just thinking about this in terms of, I guess, you know, you were using that term compliance before, or you know, the public level of buy-in for this. Is there a danger now, given that South Australia's had this kind of misstep, or has it certainly been the way it's been portrayed? And it is a misstep in the sense that, as you say, that the Premier himself has sort of walked away from it, and they did cut what was already a very short, sharp lockdown. They did cut it in half. So it was a pretty strong admission that the premise under which they'd made the decision had changed, and they decided to, you know, pull out of the full lockdown in the way that they had it. Is there a danger now that they'll be more reluctant to do it again if faced with another circumstance, and also that South Australians and indeed citizens in other parts of the country will be less inclined to take at face value such immediate sort of fiat from governments?
I think the short answer is yes, but I actually think that the government has an awful lot of agency in ameliorating that. You know, I mean, if they front up and sort of explain the chain of reasoning as to why it is they made that decision, then that actually might boost public confidence that ultimately, you know, given the information available, this was the choice they sort of made, because that's ultimately the decision that they have to make. They don't have perfect information. And that's the reality that policymakers face, despite the fact that we rarely like to talk about it in those terms. I think the final thing I would sort of say on lockdowns is, if we sort of take like a deep history perspective and we look at pandemics and viruses and death across time and space, across human history, you know, before the age of vaccines, the only thing that has ever worked is when communities have collectively decided to protect each other by isolating themselves. Mm. That is the only thing that has ended any of these waves of disease, with the absolute exception of strains of the Black Death that was so virulent that the disease killed itself by killing everyone that it came into contact with. Yeah, exactly. And so I guess that's sort of the point. Like, yeah, this is absolutely about trade-offs. It's about making decisions with imperfect information. But some of these, you know, like the things that go into the trade-off are not actually weighed equally. And it would be good if we had a bit more of a sophisticated discussion about what these trade-offs actually kind of were, rather than sort of talking in these sort of false binaries, which is, I think, where the debate sort of sits.
Yeah, well, it's worth highlighting in South Australia, there are 26 active cases of COVID from community transmission right now in South Australia. Yeah. So this is not a makeup fantasy world. There are 26.
No, that's right.
And we know that this is highly infectious. And because we don't have social distancing goods in a stringent level anymore, but simply because we have so few cases, then of course the so-called R value will be high. So it can transmit itself very quickly and increase rapidly. And indeed, Maria's point in terms of Victoria, there was substantial hidden transmission in June and July. So you go and contact trace and you ask questions of people, but those people don't truthfully provide the context they've been in connection with. Why? Because if they provide the names to the contact tracers, then those people won't be able to go and work, because they will need to get tested, and the protocol is that, you know, et cetera, that you need to wait till your test result. So they changed that in terms of the incentive. They gave a $450 payment to workers who got tested, even though they weren't found to be positive.
Yeah, that was the Victorian government, wasn't it?
That was the Victorian government. So there's a whole incentive issue here, but going hard, going quickly in South Australia, you know, if they, I think looks like they've got on top of it, that is the right call. So these people
should they have stuck with the 6 days then, do you think, rather than sort
well,
of inviting
I mean,
this?
If it works for 3 days, that's fine. But the point is, it's not some make believe thing that someone working in a pizza joint made up some story in the context that there were 26 active cases. cases that's a fact. So that was the point. And the South Australian, no doubt, the health officials who made those calls and that advice were well aware that there was a substantial hidden transmission in Melbourne. And that's what ultimately led them down that path. It got out of control. Yeah. So go in quickly. And they didn't know. But keep in mind, the testing really got underway on Monday. Okay, that's a week ago.
Yeah.
So until they did all that testing, okay, they didn't really know how widespread this was. So even that, so that information has come in the last few days, which has made a difference, of course, in terms of the call. So it's always, yes, you make a decision, but it should always be flexible and adaptable based on what the data tells you. If they got 10 more new cases today in South Australia, then I think they'd be making a different call. So it's all based on the actual data, the current data, and then make the decision based on that.
Yes, it's a fascinating area, and all governments and populations are kind of learning on the job. And to go back to Maria's point about comparators, we can certainly compare Australia with most of the rest of the world and say we're doing it pretty well here. We've been very lucky as well. I think it's fair to say we've been lucky in a lot of ways, even on climate, you might say, because and that's what I wanted to just turn to next before we have to go. But we've got obviously a Biden White House now, or we will have, supposedly. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't believe it, and some of the, frankly, bizarre people that he's had speaking for him, his lawyers, have been saying some, amazing things about how they won in a landslide. They continue to cling to that. But nonetheless, Joe Biden is going to take the US back into the Paris Climate Accords. Australia remains committed to that. And we've seen a bit of a shimmy from the Prime Minister in recent days. Perhaps, I don't know, what do you think about this, Quentin? Is Australia now, is that going to lift the pressure on Australia in terms of its climate profile, its position in the world? Is that already starting to show up in some of the Prime Minister's language? I know he told a business group last week that he was reasonably confident Australia wouldn't have to use its Kyoto carryover credits?
Well, I would think there would be a change because without the United States on side, and so to speak, in terms of taking a sort of a different perspective than most countries or rich countries are taking in terms of climate change mitigation, then I think Australia is going to be very much isolated. So being in the connected to in the club of with Saudi Arabia and Australia probably won't look so good for us. And there's already substantial pressure. I understand that there's been substantial pressure from Western Europe, from France, for example, in the context of Australia needs to sort of step up, especially in terms of the credits, the carryover credits you're talking about. So that pressure already was there. Now with the United States, with President Biden coming in, and we have a different world, I think. So I think Australia's going to have to deliver more to avoid the sorts of potential consequences that might come its way in terms of who knows what that might be in terms of the consequences of trade or some sort of tariff regimes, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the smart move is to move, not only from a political perspective, but of course it's the smart move for our planet and for our country. Mm-hmm. So let's hope that happens, and let's hope that right decisions are made in this current term of government.
Maria, do you reckon that this will happen in a way? I mean, just sort of, we all just sit here watching governments and trying to understand Scott Morrison as a still relatively new prime minister. He seems unlikely to be the sort of person who does, full back downs, but at the same time, he's very pragmatic. He's reading the way he can manipulate issues or the position of the government to the government's advantage. Do you think there's any chance that he will adopt a net zero 2050 target, or will he do things which he can convincingly say materially add up to that without actually ever mentioning the number?
I think he'll do the latter. And I guess one way to sort of think about this is the way we have talked about climate change in this country has been all about downside risks, right? Like cost to the economy, cost to jobs. And the coalition has been extremely effective at marshalling anxiety about the downside risks, which has effectively obscured any of the sort of comparative advantage that Australia in particular could capture as a result of like having endless sun and wind, basically. But what is kind of, I guess, interesting is that, the Prime Minister's already kind of crab walking out of this position because that equation around what is the actual risk is clearly sort of shifting. We saw that with the bushfires and floods and all of that kind of stuff. But we can actually sort of see that it's not just actors like the United States that is moving. I do think this is significant because it's removing another kind of the main pillar that the coalition has used, which is, well, it's good for the economy. And, you know, whilst the United States and China are polluting, like it doesn't make a difference. And China has committed and the United States will recommit to Paris. And so that argument is kind of sliding away. But also, like, we see other actors moving, right? The New South Wales state government, that's a Liberal government from his own state, you know, with the treasurer that is from the right faction, that is moving in the direction of acting on climate change. You know, business has been lobbying this government for a really long time.
All the big business bodies for net zero 50 and 20.
Business Council of Australia has been giving that advice.
The divestment movement in by superannuation funds and shareholders, like, you know,
and banks, basically.
And banks like they won't fund these projects anymore. Like, it's pretty clear which way the wind is blowing. I mean, I think the reason why he hasn't moved more explicitly and won't is because the recalcitrants are in his party room.
Well, there's a few recalcitrants on the Labor side as well.
Yes, which are only helping him, I think.
These people are serving it up to him, really.
That's right. You know.
But there is a legitimate problem, and I've written about this in the conversation today, and I therefore direct listeners to that if they want to have a look at that. But I'm making the point there that, you know, there's effectively two Australias here, right? I mean, and this is Labor's problem. Joel Fitzgibbon makes the point there are a lot of people who work in the coal and energy sector up and down the east coast of Australia who traditionally are Labor bedrock sort of supporters, but who no longer see the Labor Party as their party because they say Labor's been captured by the inner cities, by elite opinion, and that their jobs are the jobs that are going to go. So what is the solution? I mean, this is what Anthony Albanese must now manage. He may be only 12 months from an election, and he needs to find a way of talking to these two Australians if he's going to retain those seats. And also if he is going to look like if Labor is going to look like the party that it has traditionally been, which is the party of working people, right? So, I mean, I've proposed that that one way they could do that is they should have an enormous, and I mean like deliberately enormous, sort of future fund, a transition future fund, which would be as dramatic as paying coal workers displaced by a change, paying them to transition into other industries, perhaps even going as far as buying their houses. If houses, because, you know, local economies collapse, you suddenly owe the bank more for your house than the house is worth because the smelter is closed down or whatever it is. I'm wondering whether that isn't the way to go about this, to say to effectively to these communities but also to the broader nation that driving down emissions and having a greener economy is a national project, and there is no reason that just because you happen to be caught in the hinge point of that change that you should carry the cost of it. We should all carry the cost of it. So what do you think of that kind of idea, Quinn?
Look, we have a long history of restructuring in Australia where there is some change that happens, and we can talk to dairy industry, we can talk to sugar, we can talk to timber, you know. So, and typically there's money put on the table to try and assist, compensation, if you will, or some assistance for the losers. So that's I think it's consistent with that approach. The question is who are the losers, and how do we determine it, and what is the size of the sum, and what are they going to get? Because there'll be a lot of people who aren't doing so well at the moment who are not in the mining community, COVID, for example, they might be saying, well, hang on, how about us? You know, so that's always the challenge when you have these sorts of funds. But in principle, the idea that there are losers from a public decision making that is in the national or the public interest need to be assisted is perfectly fine with me. I would point out, though, that there's lots of other losers in the world, including in Australia, losers in the sense that they're not doing well through no fault of their own, just through where they happen to be living in a remote community, for example, that those sorts of people shouldn't be forgotten either in the so-called future fund. So I think the other thing I'd put to this as well. We also have a problem in this country, and it's not unique to Australia, is that when you create these funds, you get what I would call the vested interest coming in, swooping in to see how they can spend this money and reallocate that money for themselves. And I can talk about it to the water space, for example. You know, billions of dollars have been spent that should have gone into helping communities. In fact, has gone into a bunch of concrete and a bunch of pipes to help just a very small number of
irrigators.
So we have to be very cognizant that there's the possibility of gaming this, especially if it's a very large fund, is very, very high. So we'd have to set up the probity and all that sort of stuff behind it if it's going to be successful.
Well, I think it needs to be big, and I agree it probably would encounter some of those problems. But Labor does need to have a story, and it's not just a story to those people. Because you think about the way this issue is politically parlayed. You were making the point before, Maria, about how good Scott Morrison and the coalition have been at kind of leveraging up fear about change. Labor can't afford to leave these people behind because of their direct electoral impact, but it also can't afford to be seen to be cavalier about the loss of jobs, because that's a more corrosive charge right across the board, you know, and that really has done Labor a lot of damage, particularly right through Queensland. Even people not in mining communities, have not been supporting Labor. I mean, the primary vote's around 25%. Labor can't win with a 34-35% primary vote, right? So they need a story to tell. And I think the story needs to be about nation building and about this transformation and about driving it rather quickly, because 2050 is not that far away. You know, there are targets that will have to be met on the way to that. So that's what I'd argue, that this is actually a different character of thing. There are all those other issues, as Quentin says, that need to be addressed, but this is about a national pivot, I suppose, and about a narrative that Labor needs to be able to talk to people about if it's to have any chance of neutralising this issue between now and the next election.
Well, in some ways, that's actually quite consistent with someone like Joel Fitzgibbon's own position on this, which is, you know, he will sort of say, like, well, miners in my community, you know, they don't want their children to be coal miners either. They want them to be doctors and nurses and to do the sort of usual aspirational sort of stuff. But, you know, they've got mortgages on their expensive properties and they earn quite a bit of money, actually, coal miners. It's a well-paid job. And
means they support economies too.
Precisely. But that also sort of means that the jobs that they might be substituting into perhaps aren't as well paid. And that is a significant loss. And I can understand exactly why coal mining communities might feel that they might not believe governments when they say they're going to look after them, because look at the auto workers or look at manufacturing businesses at the time of the recession in the 1990s. You know, many of these, and they were largely men, never worked again. And so I think, you know, what you're saying, Mark, is potentially one way of Labor resolving this issue, because they can't win off the back of the inner city left vote. So even though that is effectively where their party is at, they need to find a way to sort of build a coalition more broadly. And the sort of demographic and political changes that are happening in some of these seats are kind of making a lot of these voters more natural coalition voters. But there is an appetite in these places for state interventions, and perhaps this is one way of addressing it. But I just keep thinking about the dairy industry, where a levy was put on and a lot of farmers took that levy, and there was not the kind of incentive structure to get people to change their practices. And once that levy period ran out, and you had a sort of situation with the supermarkets, that a lot of them just went to the wall.
Mm. There's a lot of problems here.
And keep in mind that the whole point of this is not about Labor getting re-elected or getting elected. No. So the whole point is that we have an energy transition, that we do something in this country and, of course, globally, so we get better outcomes. We don't get catastrophic
climate
change.
But you have to get the politics right. I mean, because if you don't, you can't do it. You can't change the country from opposition.
I get that. Yeah. I get that. Yeah. Yeah. So, but the question is the devil is in the detail here of how it gets done.
Mm. Yes, and speaking of not being able to change the country from opposition, 2019 election was a good example of that, perhaps the exemplar of that, given the range of things that Labor was proposing from the non-Treasury benches, and we saw how that ended. Now, look, I see as we look up at the clock that we've been going for an hour. That's longer than we normally go, but it's just been such an absorbing discussion. So thank you both to Quentin Grafton and to Maria Taflaga, and thank you for listening to Democracy Sausage. I'll be back later in the week. I think I'm going to be able to bring you a talk with Malcolm Knox, the author variously sports writer, literary editor, general polymath, and he's written a fabulous new book called Truth is Trouble, and it's a rather interesting examination of the Israel-Folau affair and what that told us about ourselves and the nature of debate in this country and the way politics works, particularly on the Christian right. So I hope that we can bring you that later in the week. I'm doing an in-conversation or meet the author with Malcolm Knox in a couple of days' time. We'll try and bring you that. Until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.